This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Phyllis Bennis joins us to discuss the recent eruption of violence in Gaza and Israel.
Phyllis, who's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, explains to our listeners why the United States must commit to ending the violence, all the violence, in Israel-Palestine. We also speak today with Professor Rashid Khalidi about the recent assassination of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh.
He puts it into context of Israel as a colonial settler state. Rashid Khalidi is the great historian in the area.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. On October 7th, Hamas fired 2,000 missiles from the Gaza Strip into Israel and sent hundreds of fighters into Israel, killing hundreds of Israeli civilians. Israel retaliated with overwhelming force, bombing Gazan civilians, homes, mosques, schools, and civilian buildings. As we record this interview on October 11th, Israel is reportedly planning to mount a ground offensive into Gaza with 360,000 Israeli reserve troops poised to invade. As of today, at least 1,200 Israelis and 950 Palestinians have been killed and tens of hundreds have been wounded on both sides. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared war on Hamas, but Israel's actions reveal that Israel is mounting war on the Palestinian people as a whole, especially those in Gaza. Targeting civilians constitutes a war crime under the Geneva Convention, regardless of who commits them. And if we're serious about stopping all war crimes, it's crucial that we understand the context. Hamas's offensive was launched in the context of decades of the Israeli apartheid regime and settler colonialism. Here with us to unpack this tragic situation is Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who serves as the international advisor for Jewish Voice for Peace and is a member of the National Board of Veterans for Peace. Her most recent book is the seventh updated edition of Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, A Primer, which was published in 2018. Phyllis wrote an article in The Hill titled As Israel and Gaza Erupt, the U.S. Must Commit to Ending the Violence, All the Violence. Phyllis Bennis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
In your new article published in The Hill, you write that condemning attacks on civilians by both Israel and Hamas isn't enough. It's necessary to examine the root causes of the violence. Although it's impossible to explain what has happened in Israel-Palestine for the past 75-plus years, can you give us a brief explanation of the context, please?
I think what we're dealing with is a systemic level of oppression that has been going on, as you say, for 75 years. Actually, more than that, because colonization of historic Palestine began at the turn of the 20th century, so even further than the 75 years ago when the State of Israel was created. But from that time, in the war between Israeli settlers and Palestinian indigenous people in 1947-48, at the end of that war, about 750,000 Palestinians, a huge percentage of the entire population, had been expelled from their homes. They had been dispossessed of their homes. They had been driven out at gunpoint or frightened out with the threat of massacres that went on as part of the war. And many, many of the 2 million people who now live in Gaza are the descendants of those first refugees from what is now the State of Israel. So all of that has been going on for generations. And And in looking back at that process of settler colonialism, what we see is that the form of it, the form that it takes, is that of apartheid. And it's important when we think about that not to see it in the context of this is just like South Africa. It's not anything like South Africa. And the nature of South African apartheid and Israeli apartheid really don't look alike at all. What they share is that they both violate the international covenant against the crime of apartheid, which speaks directly to this idea that you have a single territory governed by one governing agency, one government, in this case, all of Israel, all of the West Bank, all of Gaza, all of East Jerusalem, are all controlled by the government of the State of Israel and the military of the State of Israel. But how you're governed, what rights you have or don't have, are determined by where in that contiguous territory you reside. So if you're a Jewish Israeli citizen, you're at the top of the hierarchy of rights. You have all the rights of citizenship. If you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel inside the 48 lines, you have some rights. You have the right of voting, but you don't have equal rights by law. You're denied equality. A new law says that only Jews have the right of self-determination in the State of Israel. So Jim Crow-style segregation, what we would consider apartheid, is built into the legal system of Israel. If you're a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank, you have no rights. You have no right to have any say in the government that controls everything about your life through checkpoints, through the militarization of life on a daily basis. If you live in Gaza, you're at what we might say is the bottom of that hierarchy of rights. You have not only no rights, but you live under a state of siege. And that has been going on, the siege of Gaza, for 16 years. Children in Gaza, and, you know, half the population of Gaza, of 2 million people, half of it is under the age of 19, 18 years and younger, is half the population. That's 1 million people. And those young people have grown up knowing nothing but living under a complete siege. Almost none of them have ever left the Gaza Strip. Almost none of them have ever had access to the outside world in any real way. And the impact of that has affected everything about their lives, right down to basic survival. I just, in sort of researching some of this in the last day, I learned something I had never known, which is that today, as of May of this year, long before this particular crisis erupted, 20% of the children of Gaza are stunted by the age of 2, because the siege means that insufficient good food is allowed into the strip. Now we're hearing about a new siege that is completely cutting off food, water, electricity, and fuel. That's a call for genocide. That means people are going to die directly and deliberately as a result of a specific policy designed to do exactly that. So when we talk about the structural oppression of Palestinians, that's what we're talking about. Now, none of that makes attacks on civilians, for instance, morally acceptable or legal under international law. People living under occupation, under military occupation, do have the right of resistance and the right of armed resistance. But that right does not extend to attacking civilians. So this is not about justifying attacks on civilians. It's about understanding how that happens, why it happens. Because without that, we have no chance of understanding or figuring out how to make sure it never happens again.
Phyllis, how has Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right government exacerbated this situation?
Well, you know, the government that has come into power this last year in Israel is by far the most extremist far-right government Israel has ever had. And it's had some pretty right-wing governments. So in this context, you have a combination of the right-wing, the far-right, the extreme right, and what I carefully call the fascist right. And that's because at least one of the top ministers, the Minister of Finance, Smotrich, calls himself a fascist. He He defines himself proudly as a fascist homophobe. That's his political identity that he has claimed for himself. So this is a fascist government. And what that means in terms of Palestinians is you hear things like the claim that in Gaza we are dealing with human animals and there are no more rules. That comes from the defense minister. You know, these are the kinds of extremists that the government of Netanyahu has have brought into their positions of power. For Netanyahu, he doesn't necessarily agree with some of those positions, but it really doesn't matter whether he does or not, because he has brought them in knowing that only this far-right coalition, very, very narrow coalition, including parties that were prohibited from even running for office, one of whom, because the leader of the party, who's now a member of this cabinet, had been arrested and is a convicted supporter of terrorism, was convicted of supporting a terrorist organization, which in Israel, given the widespread level of anti-Arab racism, to be convicted of terrorism because of your racism, you can imagine how extreme you have to be. Well, this guy is now a minister in this government. Netanyahu brought in that government because they are the only ones who can keep him out of jail. They are the only ones who will agree to keep him on as prime minister, so they remain in power. They remain able to steal more land in the West Bank. The level of annexation has escalated. The attacks by settlers under the protection of the military on Palestinians in the West Bank has dramatically escalated. All of that is going on. But Netanyahu remains prime minister, so he doesn't go to jail in any of the four sets of trials that he is facing, any of which could send him to prison if he was not given immunity as long as he's the prime minister. So for Netanyahu, this is personal. This is about staying out of jail.
So basically, Netanyahu made a deal with the devil to stay in power, or a worse devil, I guess you would say.
He had already been dealing with the devil, but yeah, these are like the worst of the worst, for sure.
Right. Apparently, Israel is about to mount a full-scale ground invasion of Gaza. I think 360,000 troops are at the ready. And Netanyahu told the people of Gaza that they should leave. Why can't they leave?
They can't leave because Gaza remains besieged. Gaza is surrounded by a militarized wall with electronic sensors, all of those things. And there's no way out. The two gates that go from Gaza into Israel and the one gate that goes from Gaza into Egypt are shut. No one can leave. The break in the wall that was part of the Hamas breakout, if you will, of this open-air prison in which Gazans, all 2.2 million Gazans live, that breakout included physically breaking down the wall in one place. But that's now been repaired, or somehow it's now back under Israeli control. The Israeli military is in complete control of the surroundings of Gaza, as they have been since 2005, when the soldiers and settlers within Gaza were pulled out and resettled, if you will, on the outskirts of Gaza, surrounding it. So Gaza has never been free. People in Gaza can't simply go to the West Bank or go into Israel or into Egypt. They live in a walled, besieged city. And there is nowhere to go. There is nowhere safe. People are fleeing their homes and running to the schools run by UNRWA, the UN agency for Palestinian refugees. But those are not safe. They don't have bomb shelters underneath them. These are flimsy buildings already. Many of them have already been hit. Many have been destroyed already, and the impact is devastating. There's a new report just in the last hours from Defense for Children International, Palestine section, that at least 326 Palestinian children in Gaza have already been killed by Israeli airstrikes since Saturday, and that's before this escalation that we're hearing is about to happen. One of the questions, of course, will be what happens to the Israeli hostages, which includes some foreigners, some Americans among them, that are being held somewhere in Gaza, and whether their presence will act as any kind of a way of tamping down the ferocity of the attack that is to come. But so far, it's not looking that way. It's looking like the efforts towards a return of the hostages, perhaps in a prisoner swap, where, for example, the children among the prisoners, among the hostages, could be exchanged for the several dozen children that are being held in Israeli military jails illegally under, in violation of the International Covenant for the Rights of the Child and a host of other international laws, exchanging children for children. Israel does not seem yet willing to do that. But if they give up on the prisoner on the hostage exchange idea, there will be nothing more stopping them from an incredible level of brutality, far worse than anything we've already seen, where hundreds and hundreds of Palestinians in Gaza have already been killed. A large percentage of them, children, have already been killed since Saturday by Israeli bombing.
Phyllis, some commentators are saying that the Palestinian people do not support Hamas. What is your understanding of this?
Hamas came to power in an election in 2006. That was the last time that the Palestinians in the occupied territory, including both the West Bank and Gaza, were able to have elections. They won the election, rather surprising everybody. I was in Palestine at that time, at the time of the elections, and I know an awful lot of people who voted for Hamas, not because they liked Hamas. They hated Hamas for all kinds of reasons, not least that these are secular Palestinians who had no truck with the kind of religious framework for governing that Hamas brought to it. But they were tired of the corruption and failure of the Palestinian Authority led by Fatah, one of the key components of the PLO, the organization once led by Yasser Arafat. And they were done with that, and they were voting for Hamas as a protest vote. Now, how much of a percentage was a protest vote, and how much of that percentage, how much of those voters who supported Hamas actually did support Hamas, I don't know. What is clearly true is that in the years since, when there's been no more elections, either in the West Bank or in Gaza, so that both the Hamas authorities in Gaza and the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority, the so-called PA, in the West Bank, have virtually no credibility and legitimacy anymore within the population. They just have not been able to produce an end to the occupation, which is their real goal. Now, I think the reality is that this breakout attack by Hamas is likely to increase Hamas's support, even for people who may hate the violence with which they attacked civilians inside Israel, will see that what they first did was break out of this besieged, tiny, crowded territory. And for people who have never lived under military occupation, to live under siege for 16 years, it's a whole generation, who have grown up knowing nothing else, they will get support for that. They will get more support than they've probably had until now. So I think it's a very fluid situation, but I do think it's important not to assume that because there have not been elections for a long time and there's issues of credibility and that sort of thing for Hamas, that somehow they have no support. They have plenty of support among the population, particularly in Gaza. So we have to take that seriously.
Yes. Phyllis, after Hamas's October 7th attack, Joe Biden condemned Hamas for killing Israeli civilians, but he didn't mention the deaths of Palestinian civilians. This double standard is consistent with the U.S. government's history of uncritical support for Israel. How does the United States enable Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory?
You know, Margie, there's a host of ways that U.S. support enables the continuation of the Israeli policies of apartheid and oppression of Palestinians. The biggest one, the most obvious, is the money. You know, the U.S. money, our tax dollars, to the tune of $3.8 billion a year as a starting point, and it's almost always raised. This year it will be raised enormously more than the $3.8 billion. That's the floor. That's the starting point. That money represents 20% of the entire Israeli military budget. Their budget is, you know, way smaller than ours. It's a pittance of our budget, but it's 20%. It's a fifth of the entire Israeli military budget. That's huge. We don't do that for any other country. So that's one way. Now, beyond that, the collaboration at a military level, the strategic relationship, is a huge component of making Israel by far the strongest military power, despite its small size, in the entire region. But beyond the military, you have very important diplomatic support that is a key component of enabling the Israeli policies to go forward without any accountability. One is the U.S. process of almost always, there's a couple of exceptions, but almost always using its veto in the Security Council to prevent the passage of any resolution that might criticize Israeli violations of international law and human rights. And one of the effects of that is to make sure that most of those resolutions never even come up for a vote, because other countries don't want to bother forcing a vote when the U.S. is going to be very mad at them for voting the wrong way if it's not going to pass anyway, because they know the U.S. will veto. So they let the U.S. off the hook, especially right now, because in the last 2 years, a new resolution passed in the U.N. that requires for any vote in the Security Council on issues of peace and security where a veto is issued and prevents the passage of a resolution, that resolution and its subject, whatever the subject is to go directly to the General Assembly for debate. That was always something that was possible, but it had to be voted on, it had to be agreed to, etc. Now it's mandated. So that's huge. It means that any time there's an actual veto cast, the General Assembly, which is by far the more democratic component of the UN structures, can take up that issue. So the fact that U.S. power in the Security Council goes even beyond the casting of a veto, but makes sure that by simply threatening a veto, other countries pull back, it's enormous protection for Israel. The U.S. makes sure that Israeli officials, as individuals, both political and military leaders, are never held accountable for their war crimes, for any alleged violations of international law, violations of UN resolutions, violations of human rights. They are granted a level of impunity that is not granted to the officials of any other country. So all of that makes it possible for Israel to go on carrying out these illegal policies in violation of the Geneva Conventions, violation of the International Covenant Against Apartheid, violations of all kinds of UN resolutions and international law, without ever being held accountable. And that makes it just much easier for the oppression of Palestinians, for the apartheid system to continue.
Also, the International Criminal Court launched a formal investigation of war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in the Palestinian territory, and the U.S. has stymied that investigation to make sure it doesn't proceed.
Phyllis, the UN Security Council met but refused to take any action to stop the carnage in Gaza. You're also an expert on the UN, so can you please explain what the positions were of the U.S., China, and Russia, three permanent members of the Security Council?
Well, this was one of those discussions that never led to a resolution. So there was no actual vote where we could say China voted this way, the U.S. voted that way, Russia voted that way. This was one of those discussions where they never got to the question of a possible actual resolution. In this case, I don't think it would have been 14-1 use of the veto. The degree to which U.S. power, economic power, military power, strategic power, diplomatic power, all those things, so often skews the way discussions go forward and the way resolutions do or do not even get tabled at the United Nations was very much in play. And we didn't see an actual resolution come to a vote, which is what happens very often. I think that what's important here is that there is agreement between the major powers to agree to sideline the United Nations. The UN is, of course, playing a huge role in trying to figure out a way to get crucial water, electricity, food, medicine into the Strip with this new level of increased closure, an increased siege where nothing is being allowed in. That's a call to genocide. And the UN is, through its agencies, is playing a huge humanitarian corridor, also to figure out if there's a way to allow people to get out of Gaza. So far, that has not come into play. I think it probably will in the next day or so, but we don't even know that for sure. But the UN as a political actor has been absolutely sidelined, and that has been true in the UN for far too long. You know, if we go back to even before the so-called Oslo process that led to the calls for a two-state solution and the so-called peace process that diverted attention for so many years, we had the conference in Madrid, which was based on a somewhat different approach. Instead of saying, let's bring the Palestinians and Israelis together as if they were equals, we'll pretend that they are negotiating as equals, and we'll see where that goes. And, of course, we know where that went. It didn't go anywhere. But the Madrid conference was based on the idea, well, let's first get Israel together with the Arab countries, and then eventually the Palestinians will just have to come along. And in Madrid, one of the components of the agreements with Israel to participate, you know, when they have these conferences, every country is given a set of guarantees about the terms of their participation. And in that case, Israel was given guarantees that the United Nations would not be allowed to participate. It was said explicitly in the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding given to Israel, that the United Nations would be allowed to have a single representative present who would not be allowed to speak, that he, it was assumed it would be a he, and at that time it usually was, that he would be allowed to speak to other delegates in the halls, but would not be allowed to participate in the debate. It was this incredible insult to the world organization, right? But it was a clear indication of what the power relations were. This was Washington's conference, and they were going to determine who was allowed to participate, to speak, etc., and the UN just was not to be given a role. At the qualitative level, that hasn't changed a whole lot. The UN is relied on for all of its humanitarian agencies, the World Health Organization, the World Food Program, UNICEF, all of those play a huge role, as well as UNRWA, the Agency for Palestinian Refugees. But the idea that the UN should be in charge of actual diplomatic arrangements, no, they are simply excluded from the process.
Well, Phyllis, we're almost out of time. What, if anything, can the international community and our listeners do to end the violence?
This is the most important and the most difficult question. The international community is not what the U.S. claims it is, which is the countries of North America, Europe, and Japan, and South Korea, basically, and the rest of the world is ignored. But the international community of people, the international community of social movements, we have a huge set of obligations arising out of this crisis. The first one, for those of us who live in the United States, is to keep the pressure on our government to call for an immediate ceasefire. That's not on the agenda of the Biden administration. It's not, unfortunately, on the agenda of pretty much anybody yet in Congress. And that is a very dangerous reality. It's going to be a very difficult challenge to get past the level of emotion that was, not surprisingly, sparked by the level of violence of the first attacks by Hamas, on particularly on Saturday and Sunday, when so many Israeli civilians, as well as many military people, were killed in horrific ways. So the outrage about that is absolutely justified. But we have to get beyond that to say that does not justify the imposition of a potentially genocidal new policy by Israel. There was something that was said by Biden in his speech yesterday that I think was particularly important. Most of what he said was exactly what we expected. But he essentially compared Israel's experience with the U.S. experience around 9/11. He didn't name it that way, but that's what he was referring to. And he said, he was talking about his call with Netanyahu, and he said, I told Netanyahu, if the United States experienced what Israel is experiencing, our response would be swift, decisive, and overwhelming. Well, the reality is, at the time of 9/11, Bush's response was swift, decisive, and overwhelming, and wrong. We did that, it was that, and it failed. And if we don't take that into account, Israel is going to be in exactly the same position of launching a potentially 20 or even longer year war against Palestinians and potentially more broadly in the region. Biden went on to say, we also discussed how democracies like Israel and the United States are stronger and more secure when we act according to the rule of law. Well, that's absolutely true. They are, and we didn't, so it failed. That's the lesson we need to learn. So we need to be pushing for an immediate ceasefire, and we need to be pushing against the idea that that the U.S. has a role to play militarily by sending more weapons, more F-16s, more bombs, more guns, more bullets, as if that is going to somehow solve the problem. There is no military solution here. And if there was such an enormous intelligence failure in Israel, which may or may not even be the case, but whatever it was, that's not going to be solved by sending F-16s and bombs. If there was an inability of the military to respond quickly when civilians were being attacked, that's not going to be dealt with by sending more F-16s and bombs and guns. We need to approach the entire crisis differently. That is to say, if we want to stop violence, we need to stop the circumstances that give rise to violence. And that means fighting for equality, for human rights, for everybody. Everybody who lives from the river to the sea deserves to live in safety, deserves to live with dignity, deserves to live in their own land. And this isn't about states. This isn't about one state, two states. It's about rights. Right now, it's about stopping bombing of Gaza because we're killing children. And I say we because we are complicit with the Israelis. As long as we continue to send billions of dollars, hundreds of planes, bombs, bullets, etc., we are complicit in the war crimes that the Israeli military is carrying out. It's not okay to identify one side's violations of international law and potential war crimes and ignore the other side, which is violating the rights of far more people and killing potentially far more than has already been the case in the horrific levels of violence that have already gone on. We have an enormous job ahead, and it's not going to be easy, but this is what our new obligations are.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, thank you so much. I hope every person in this country can hear this interview because it's critical, and this is information that does not get into the corporate media. People are so polarized. So thank you for this. Thank you for your work at the Institute for Policy Studies, and we hope to have you back very soon.
Thanks. I look forward to it. People can find my most recent article in The Hill.
Thanks, Phyllis. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Zionist colonial settler state of Israel is not the moral legatee of the victims of the Holocaust, much less the moral legatee of the ancient prophets of the Jewish people. Never has this been more evident with the exposure of the Israeli army's assassination of the beloved Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Assassination is a political murder. Shireen had covered the Israeli military's occupation of the West Bank for Al Jazeera for 25 years. The day she was killed, she was reporting on the Israeli military invasion of Jenin, an Arab town in the West Bank occupied by the Israeli army for 55 years. She was wearing a helmet and a protective vest marked PRESS. It is the practice of the Israeli army to shoot journalists and otherwise suppress the truth of their war crimes, including the illegal theft of Palestinian lands. Israel's brutal occupation has been going on since it illegally seized the West Bank as a prize of the 1967 war between Israel and three of its Arab neighbors. Since then, the Israeli military has ruled the native Arabs. Shireen is the 86th journalist to be killed while covering Israel's illegal occupation since 1967. The murder of Shireen was not adequately exposed by the U.S. press. The United States supports Israel politically, ideologically, economically, and morally. The U.S. gives the State of Israel more than $3.8 billion a year in weapons. Shireen was killed by a high-velocity, armor-piercing 5.56-millimeter bullet fired from a Ruger Mini 14 semi-automatic rifle. The weapon was made in the USA. Israel has refused to conduct an investigation of Shireen's assassination because it, quote, would provoke opposition and controversy within the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, and in Israeli society in general, end quote, according to the Israeli government. Although complaints have been filed in the International Criminal Court against Israel, the court does not appear to have the political will to thoroughly investigate those charges. There's an apocryphal story of three rabbis dispatched from a Zionist Congress in Vienna many years ago to report back on the situation in Palestine. They reported back that the bride is beautiful, but she's married to another man. The claim of the Zionists is that Israel was built on a land without a people, for a people without a land. This is Israeli propaganda. This propaganda is less and less swallowed by the new generations in the United States and Europe as they witness Israel taking over more and more of historic Palestine and attempting to prevent the truth of what they are doing from coming out. It is no longer swallowed by many Israeli scholars who have left their country to work in the United States or England. Here to discuss the assassination of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh is returning guest Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi. He is a Palestinian-American historian of the Middle East, the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University, and director of the Middle East Institute of Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. He was educated at Yale and Oxford universities and is the author of many books on the Middle East. His latest is The Hundred Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. Professor Rashid Khalidi, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Rashid, you've said that Israel's colonial army has systematically targeted Palestinian journalists. Please explain why.
Well, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. In the last 22 years, I think, 46 Palestinian journalists have been killed. And since the occupation began, over 80, that is to say, in the past 55 years. During its attack on Gaza last spring in May, Israel destroyed the building in which AP and Al Jazeera had their headquarters. All of the journalists there were Palestinian. Fortunately, none of them were killed. But the destruction of a building with news organizations in it is an indication of how important it is to Israel to shoot the messenger, sometimes literally killing the messenger, as in the case of Shireen Abu Akleh, unfortunately many others. But generally speaking, targeting journalists, harassing journalists, the BBC had journalists beaten up the other day during the so-called flag march, I think a week ago Sunday. And that's par for the course. The messenger reveals the horrors of an occupation that's gone on for 55 years and of a colonial system that's been there for many, many decades more. The easiest way to stop those pictures and those images and words about them from getting out is to attack the messenger. It's a tried and true method. In addition, of course, to bullying editors and journalists.
Thanks, Rashid. Shireen Abu Akleh was covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp when she was assassinated. Why do you think Israel targeted her there? Why is Jenin an iconic symbol?
Well, Jenin was the site of one of the most ferocious battles that was fought during the Second Intifada in 2002. Israel attacked the refugee camp there in particular. The whole area has been a hotbed of resistance, the whole Jenin area, but the refugee camp adjacent to the town of Jenin, to the city of Jenin, was a particular target of the Israelis during their reoccupation of the towns and cities of the West Bank in 2002. During that battle, over 20 Israeli soldiers were killed. Double that number of Palestinians were killed, about half of whom, or a little more than half of whom, were combatants, and about half of whom were civilians. Jenin has been, as you suggested, iconic for Palestinians, but it's also a symbol of resistance that the Israelis are determined to erase, whence their constant attacks on the Jenin area. Every time anything happens, Israel unleashes its army and its security forces on Jenin, and in particular on the Jenin refugee camp, which is near where Shahin Abu Ali was murdered.
Collective punishment is a war crime. How does Israel use collective punishment to oppress the Palestinians?
It does so in innumerable ways. One typical example is the blowing up of the houses of families when an individual from that family is alleged to have carried out an attack. This is punishment of the entire family for the act of an individual. Another example is curfews of an entire district, neighborhood, village, sometimes region, as punishment. Withdrawal of permits for movement. The Israelis control all movement in the occupied territories. And so if they withdraw the permits that allow people to circulate, they're basically under a sort of extended form of house arrest. All of these are forms of collective punishment. There are many, many others.
Rashid, why is it significant that Shireen was a Palestinian American? How do you think the Western media response to her assassination would have differed if she had been, say, Ukrainian?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, had she been Ukrainian, the noise would never have stopped. The extraordinary difference between the way that the media heroicizes and vaunts Ukrainian resistance to Russian occupation and how it describes Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation as terrorism is an example of a hypocritical double standard in the Western media. And had, I mean, for hopefully no Ukrainian journalists will be killed, but were one to be killed, I'm sure we would see a level of hype that goes far beyond anything that had to do with the response to the killing of Shireen Abu Ali. I would add that had she not been a Palestinian American, much of the media coverage would not have occurred. In other words, the fact that she happened to hold an American passport, I think, probably amplified the Western media coverage. It has had absolutely no impact, of course, on the United States government, which doesn't care if American citizens who happen to be Palestinians are killed. She's the second Palestinian American to be killed in the last several months. An elderly man who had been playing cards with his family and was going home late at night was stopped by an Israeli patrol. This was in, I believe, February, when it was quite cold outside. He had his hands tied behind his back. He was blindfolded, and he was dumped on the ground, and he died of a heart attack. That's another American killed by Israeli soldiers. No investigation, no comment from the United States government, as far as I can remember, except the usual tut-tutting. While the weapons and the other material support for this occupation from the United States continues unabated. The same thing has happened with Shireen Abu Ali. Secretary of State Blinken was aggressively questioned during the summit of the Americas in Los Angeles Thursday about why the U.S. government has done nothing. And he said, well, we're waiting for the results. It's not clear what happened. We're waiting for the results of an investigation. An American citizen being killed should provoke an American investigation, but of course that's not going to happen. The United States will defer to Israel, which will investigate itself and whitewash itself as it always does. Nobody is ever convicted for killing Palestinians, and if they do, they never serve any time in the Israeli military. It is an ironclad rule. Dozens of Palestinians have been shot down, unarmed Palestinians have been shot down in the past several weeks. Nobody is ever investigated, let alone convicted of that, by the Israeli military.
Rashid, didn't the Israeli government say that it is refusing to investigate Shireen's killing?
They did that, but they also said that they demanded to be handed over the bullet, which the Palestinian autopsy recovered from the body of Shireen Abu Ali. And they say that they won't do anything unless the Palestinians agree to a joint investigation. And the Palestinians have rightly said that, you know, the murderer is not the person to investigate their own crime. So that's where that is. An Israeli investigation is not an investigation. An Israeli investigation is necessarily and inevitably a whitewash. So it's a joke that Blinken and the Israelis are talking about this.
Rashid, Israeli propaganda claims that Israel is a tiny island of democracy in a sea of hostile Arabs. Is this story believed by young Americans now, particularly Jewish young Americans?
I think one of the more encouraging developments in recent years is the degree to which younger people in the United States, and I think the world over, are less and less susceptible to these propaganda lines. Making the desert bloom, tiny little Israel surrounded by hordes of fanatical Arabs, and so on and so forth. I mean, we all know these tropes, which are believed implicitly by many older people in the United States and elsewhere, but which are regarded as nonsense by most younger people, or many increasing numbers, I should say, of younger people. This is true in the Jewish community. It's true everywhere else. It's true among other minorities. It's true among young people everywhere, university students and others. They are fortunate in having access to other than the mainstream corporate media, that is to say, through social media and through their access to all kinds of international sources. They know much more of the truth than the older generation ever was able to access, because you were dependent on media that were subject to extraordinary pressures, both on the ground in Palestine and in New York. When the report would come back, it would be bowdlerized, tenderized, edited such that anything unfavorable to Israel was either eliminated or pushed down to paragraph 27. And that means that younger people have a much clearer view of reality. So these ludicrous tropes, I mean, Israel is a nuclear superpower that has bombed 8 of its neighbors. It is an aggressive expansionist state that's been in occupation since its formation, since 1967, I should say, of the entirety of the West Bank, and controls the Gaza Strip from outside, and is in occupation of the Golan Heights and of Arab East Jerusalem. Young people see that. They see what the occupation is. And this argument that a country has had a military dictatorship that rules over as many people, almost, as the population of Israel itself is a democracy, is a sham. You can't be a democracy when you have under your control a population that has absolutely no rights, that is subject to a military dictatorship in which the judge and the jury and the prosecutor are all military. There is no law in the occupied territories. There's just military rule. And there's arbitrary detention, and there's murder of people without any consequences, with complete impunity. And those ideas all go against the idea of the rule of law, which is central to any democracy. So for Israeli citizens, there is certainly democracy. For the Palestinians they rule over through a military dictatorship, through this military occupation, there is none. And young people see that. And so the hypocrisy of talking about Israel as a democratic and a Jewish state at the same time is evident, especially to younger people.
So how are charges of anti-Semitism used as an excuse to distract from criticism of the Zionist occupation of Israel?
This is a tactic that reveals the bankruptcy of advocates for Israel. They actually have no arguments about things like the occupation, about things like the apartheid nature of the Israeli regime. In particular, the fact that there are two completely different systems of law in the occupied territories. The Israeli Knesset is now struggling with passing a temporary extension of the extension of Israeli law only to Israeli Jewish citizens in the occupied territories. Palestinians are not able to access Israeli law in the occupied territories. They're subject to military dictatorship. So you have two systems of law. If that's not one of the core elements of apartheid, I don't know what is. That is an example of the kind of problem that Israel has today. It cannot sell those things. So instead of peddling these well-worn and completely unbelievable nostrums, advocates of Israel are increasingly resorting to ad hominem attacks on people who are advocating for Palestinian rights by calling them anti-Semitic. This is a travesty in terms of real existing anti-Semitism, most of which, as we know, is on the right among white nationalists who peddle something called the Great Replacement Theory, which they claim involves Jews manipulating other people to replace white people. That is anti-Semitism. That is real, deadly, murderous anti-Semitism. The advocacy for Palestinian rights, on the other hand, is simply a claim that the state of Israel, not the Jews, not the Jewish people, the state of Israel, is engaged in establishing a system of apartheid, is engaged in depriving Palestinians of their rights, and has been for decades. And there's nothing anti-Semitic, nothing whatsoever that's anti-Semitic about that. It is, I think, these accusations are a revelation of the desperation and the bankruptcy of people who are advocating for Israel. There's nothing else they can say, really. I mean, how can they claim that a 55-year-old occupation is the fault of the Palestinians, which is basically the Israeli default position? Oh, there's nobody to negotiate with, or whatever nonsense they put out. Nobody believes that stuff anymore, except older people who believe pretty much anything that Israel says. But for larger and larger numbers of younger people, those things don't wash. And so they're obliged to resort to the accusation of anti-Semitism to silence people for whom that's a very serious accusation, obviously.
I just wanted to add, Rashid, that Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem have all said that Israel is an apartheid state. Is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Well, I mean, I'm a historian, and I would argue for differentiating between different forms of settler colonialism and different forms of imposed inequality that those settler colonial regimes always establish. I think there are a lot of similarities between, historically speaking now, between the regime that Israel has created in the occupied territories of two systems of rights for two different groups, two different ethnic groups, and between the system established in South Africa. There are clearly some similarities. In legal terms, I'm not a lawyer, you are, Michael. In law, as I understand it, not being a lawyer myself, it is pretty clear that Israel has met the definition in international law for apartheid. And the fact that these three human rights organizations, these three very respected human rights organizations, have come to the same conclusion would seem to validate that. As a historian, however, I would argue for enormous differences between the Israeli regime, which you can call an apartheid regime if you wish, and the original apartheid regime in South Africa. As many South Africans who suffered from apartheid have said after visiting the occupied territories, they feel that what Israel has instituted there is in many ways much worse than apartheid. But in legal terms, as I understand it, the regime that Israel has established does meet the legal definition of apartheid, which, as I say, is what these three respected groups have agreed.
And Rashid, apartheid constitutes a crime against humanity under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. 2 weeks before Shireen was assassinated, leading Palestinian journalist organizations filed a complaint in the International Criminal Court, the ICC, accusing Israel of systematically targeting Palestinian journalists, and additional complaints have been filed with the ICC stemming from Shireen's death. The Biden administration opposes an ICC investigation into her killing. Do you think the court will mount a full criminal investigation, or is U.S. pressure on the ICC too strong for any real accountability for Israel?
I mean, I wouldn't venture to predict what might happen, but I would guess that you may be right in the second part of your question, that U.S. pressure may well be too great for the ICC to proceed in this case. I think it's a tragedy that the United States is basically running interference for Israel no matter what it does. The murder of an American citizen, one might think, would rise to the level that might force this administration to actually do something to wrap Israel on the knuckles. But they are so obsessed with Israeli domestic politics, as they have been for decades. I've watched American foreign policy very closely, sometimes as a negotiator with the Israeli delegation in Washington, in the State Department. And the only thing they care about is Israeli domestic politics. How will this affect the political balance in Israel? Palestinians are run over, killed, massacred, have their rights taken away from them. That doesn't really matter to them. All that matters to them is how I'm talking about the State Department now, how this anything might affect the stability of a given Israeli government or the Israeli domestic balance. The other thing that concerns American politicians, of course, is how it will play with lobbies in the United States, whether we're talking about the right-wing Republicans who may support Israel for reasons that have to do with their evangelical beliefs, or whether it has to do with AIPAC and other groups that support Israel. That is a concern of the politicians. The State Department obsessively focuses on the stability of Israeli governments and not wanting to disturb their Israeli friends. It's a travesty and a disgrace that American diplomacy is led by people for whom Palestinian rights are of absolutely no significance, or that the continued occupation of Palestine is of no significance, by contrast with their great concern for human rights in places like the Ukraine and with Russian occupation of the Ukraine. The Russian occupation of the Ukraine has been going on since February of this year. We're, I think, in our fourth month. The Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights has been going on since 1967, 55 years. And the U.S. government pays much more attention and spends much more money, obviously, on dealing with one occupation and, in my view, ignores completely the other.
We're speaking with Professor Rashid Khalidi. Rashid, talk about the significance of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS. What is it, and how effective has it been?
Well, boycott, divestment, and sanctions is a grew out of the idea for this grew out of a movement that developed in Palestinian civil society a number of years ago. Palestinian unions, educators, intellectuals, community leaders, women's groups, and so on, got together and said, you know, in the absence of an effective Palestinian national movement with leaderships that are not doing their job, what can we do to advance the cause of Palestine abroad? And they asked others in the rest of the world to consider the idea of boycotting Israeli government institutions, of divesting from stocks that support the Israeli occupation or the Israeli war machine, and for urging their governments, people's governments, to impose sanctions on Israel for its violations of international law.
Marjorie and I are very grateful for your good work over the years, and we're very grateful for your being on Law and Disorder. Before we come to an end, can you please tell our listeners how they can follow your work, and please mention your latest book?
I hope that they will follow my work. The best way is to read the things that I've written. I mean, I write all over the place, but most importantly, this recent book that I published, The 100 Years War on Palestine, subtitle is A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, is one way that I would suggest people follow some of the arguments that I've made and the answers that I've given to Michael and Marjorie's questions. This conflict is misframed, misinterpreted, misanalyzed in a number of ways. And the thing that I try and do in the book is to put it into its proper frame. This is a settler colonial project. So that's the 100 Years War on Palestine. I've written other things that I hope people will also look at.
Thank you so much for writing this book, for being our guest on Law and Disorder, and every success in the future. You take it easy.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Marjorie.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.